The flickering flame of a candle dances inside a hollowed-out gourd, casting eerie, shifting shadows on the walls. A chill hangs in the autumn air, a feeling that something ancient and mysterious is stirring just beyond the edges of our brightly lit streets. On this one night of the year, the world seems to transform. The familiar becomes strange, and the line between our world and another darker world feels incredibly thin. We dress in costumes, transforming ourselves into ghosts, monsters, and heroes. We tell stories of spirits and specters, and we send children out into the twilight to collect candy from strangers, a playful ritual that carries the echo of something much, much older. We call it Halloween, but where did this strange and wonderful tradition actually come from? How did a night of costumes, candy, and spooky decorations begin? The answer is a story that takes us back thousands of years to a time when the world was a very different and much more mysterious place. Welcome back to How Does That Work? In today's episode, we'll be pulling back the veil on Halloween and exploring its fascinating and complex origins. To find the real beginnings of Halloween, we have to travel back in time about 2,000 years to the world of the ancient Celts. The Celtic people, who lived in the area that is now Ireland, the United Kingdom, and northern France, had a very different calendar than we do. Their new year began on November 1st, a day that marked the end of the summer and the harvest, and the beginning of the long, dark, and often dangerous winter. The night before the new year, on October 31st, they celebrated a festival called Samhain. Samhain was a time of great importance, a moment when the boundary between the world of the living and the world of the dead was believed to become blurred. The Celts believed that on this night, the ghosts of the dead could return to Earth to visit their old homes and to cause trouble. To truly understand the importance of Samhain, we have to imagine a world lit only by fire and the moon, a world where the changing of the seasons wasn't just a matter of changing your wardrobe, but a matter of life and death. For the Celtic people, the year was split into two halves, the light half, summer, and the dark half, winter. Samhain was the hinge point, the dramatic moment when the door to summer slammed shut and the door to the long cold darkness creaked open. The air itself would have felt different. It would be crisp with the coming frost, carrying the scent of wood smoke, damp earth, and the last of the harvested apples. This was a time of immense transition and anxiety. The survival of the entire community depended on what they had managed to grow and store during the light half of the year. The weeks leading up to Samhain were a period of intense work. This was the final urgent deadline set by nature. Herds of cattle and sheep that had been grazing freely in summer pastures were rounded up and brought back to the villages for the winter. This was a crucial moment of accounting. The community would decide which animals were strong enough to survive the winter and which needed to be slaughtered. The last of the grains, fruits, and nuts were harvested and brought into storage. The success or failure of this final harvest would determine who ate well and who went hungry during the lean months ahead. So while Samhain was a festival, it was also a time of judgment and preparation, the final deep breath before plunging into the harshness of winter. This feeling of being on the edge between light and dark, life and death, was mirrored in their spiritual beliefs. The idea of the veil between worlds thinning wasn't just a spooky story. It was a core part of their reality. They believed the normal rules of the universe were suspended. This meant that the spirits of ancestors could walk among them, offering comfort and wisdom. Families would leave out offerings of food and drink, setting a place at their table for the souls of their departed loved ones. But this open door worked both ways. It also meant that other, less friendly spirits, mischievous fairies, and malevolent entities from the other world could cross over and cause chaos, steal livestock, or even kidnap humans. This is why disguise was so important. It wasn't just a fun costume, it was a form of supernatural camouflage, a way to trick the spirits and move through the night unseen and unharmed. At the very center of the community's response to this supernatural event were the druids and the great bonfires. The druids were more than just priests. They were the community's scientists, doctors, judges, and spiritual guides. On the night of Samhain, all the hearth fires in every family's home would be extinguished, plunging the village into a complete and total darkness. Then the druids would construct a massive bonfire, often on a hilltop, using sacred woods. This fire was the main event. It was a beacon of light and heat against the encroaching cold, a symbol of the sun's power that they hoped would return. It was also a place of ritual and sacrifice, but most importantly, it was a source of unity. Once the ceremonies were complete, each family would take a burning ember or a torch lit from the sacred bonfire back to their own home. They would use this ember to relight their personal hearth. This simple act was incredibly powerful. It meant that every family's fire, the source of their warmth and their ability to cook through the winter, was connected to the same, single, sacred flame, binding the community together to face the darkness as one. The transformation of Samhain into Halloween is one of the clearest examples of a clever and powerful strategy used by the early Christian church. When Christianity was spreading across Europe, its leaders often ran into a problem. People were deeply attached to their old pagan traditions and festivals. Simply banning these ancient celebrations was difficult and often caused resentment. So instead of trying to stamp them out completely, the church often chose to absorb them. The strategy was simple. If you can't beat them, join them, and then slowly change the meaning from the inside out. It's like taking a very popular song and writing new Christian lyrics to the familiar tune. People get to keep the melody they love, but the message becomes a Christian one. The first major step in this rebranding process happened in the 8th century. For some time, the church had a feast day to honor all of its saints and martyrs. But Pope Gregory III made a hugely important decision. He moved the date of this celebration to November 1st, the exact day that the Celts celebrated their new year. This was no accident. He established a major Christian holiday dedicated to the Holy Dead, right on top of the most significant Celtic festival for the dead. This new holiday was called All Saints' Day, but in the language of the time, it was known as All Hallows' Day, since hallow was an old word for a saint or holy person. Naturally, the night before this big celebration, October 31st, became known as All Hallows' Eve, a name that, over the centuries, was shortened and slurred together to become Halloween. But the church didn't stop there. Around the year 1000 AD, they added another layer to the holy observance. They declared November 2nd to be All Souls' Day. This was a day set aside to pray for the souls of all ordinary deceased Christians who were believed to be in purgatory, waiting to get into heaven. This was a brilliant move because it created a three-day religious event. All Hallows' Eve, All Saints' Day, and All Souls' Day. That completely covered the time of the old Samhain festival and mirrored its core themes. It provided a Christian reason to think about and honor everyone who had passed away, from the holiest saints to your own grandparents. This new Hallowtide effectively swallowed the old pagan festival whole, providing a Christian framework for all the existing traditions. With the new holidays in place, the old Samhain rituals didn't disappear. They were just given new meanings. The huge bonfires, which the Celts lit to honor their gods and ward off spirits, were allowed to continue, but they were recontextualized as fires that would frighten away the devil or represent the suffering souls in purgatory. The Celtic tradition of wearing costumes to disguise oneself from evil spirits was also adapted. People began dressing up as saints, angels, and even devils, turning the old practice into a kind of religious parade or folk play. The act of going from door to door also got a Christian makeover. It evolved into a practice called souling, where the poor would go to the homes of wealthier families and be given a pastry called a soul cake. In exchange for the food, they would promise to say a prayer for the souls of that family's dead relatives. In this way, all the familiar and beloved activities of Samhain were kept, but their purpose was cleverly redirected toward Christian beliefs, ensuring the old ways would slowly fade as the new meanings took root. The friendly and organized ritual of children shouting "trick or treat" on a neighbor's doorstep seems like a timeless tradition, but its history is far more chaotic and mischievous than you might imagine. When the old world customs of souling and guising arrived in America with waves of Irish and Scottish immigrants, they landed in a cultural melting pot. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, these traditions morphed into something uniquely American. Halloween was not yet a holiday for young children. It was a night for teenagers and young adults to cut loose, a sort of community-wide festival of pranks known as Mischief Night. At first, this mischief was relatively harmless and playful. It was a night when the normal rules of society were temporarily suspended, and young people could get away with things that would normally get them into trouble. Pranks might include soaping the windows of a local shop, tying a neighbor's doorknob to a fence, tipping over an outhouse, or disassembling a farmer's wagon and reassembling it on the roof of his barn. It was a night of organized chaos, a way for communities to blow off steam. But as the country moved into the early 20th century, and especially during the tough years of the Great Depression, these pranks began to escalate from harmless fun into outright vandalism and violence that caused real damage and fear. By the 1920s and 30s, newspapers were filled with reports of Halloween mischief gone wrong. What used to be soaping windows became smashing them. What used to be tipping over garbage cans became setting massive street fires. Gangs of young men roamed the streets of major cities, causing widespread property damage that cost thousands of dollars to repair. Halloween was becoming a serious problem, a night that many homeowners and city officials dreaded. It became clear that something had to be done to rein in the holiday and bring it back from the brink of dangerous anarchy. The solution was a conscious and community-wide effort to domesticate Halloween. Beginning in the 1930s, community leaders, parent groups, and local towns began a campaign to create safer, more organized alternatives to the chaos. They started hosting Halloween parties, parades, and costume contests in town squares and community centers. The idea was to keep the pranksters busy and off the streets by providing them with a more structured form of fun. At the same time, the practice of going door to door began to change. Instead of it being about performing a song or a trick for a treat, it became a direct negotiation. The phrase trick or treat started to appear, and it was essentially a polite but firm ultimatum. It was a way for children and their parents to say, "Give us a treat, or we will play a trick on you." It was a form of friendly extortion, a bribe offered by homeowners to protect their property from pranks. This new, tamer version of Halloween was supercharged in the years after World War II. The baby boom led to a huge increase in the number of children, and families moving to the suburbs created close-knit, safe neighborhoods that were perfect for trick-or-treating. Candy companies, seeing a golden marketing opportunity, jumped on board. They began producing and heavily advertising small, individually wrapped candies, which were much easier and safer for people to hand out than homemade treats like cookies or popcorn balls. This massive commercial push cemented trick-or-treating as the central event of Halloween, transforming it from a night of teenage mischief into the beloved, child-focused, candy-fueled ritual we know and love today. And what about the jack-o'-lantern? That tradition also comes from Ireland, but originally it had nothing to do with pumpkins. The original jack-o'-lanterns were carved out of turnips, potatoes, or beets. They were made to look like demonic faces and were placed in windows or by doors to frighten away evil spirits. The name itself comes from an old Irish folktale about a man named Stingy Jack. Jack was a miserable old drunkard, known throughout the countryside for being a penny-pinching miser and a silver-tongued trickster. He loved nothing more than a good drink and getting the better of people, and his reputation was so great that it eventually reached the ears of the devil himself, who grew curious about this mortal who was supposedly so clever and corrupt. One fateful night, the devil decided to see for himself and appeared to Jack to tell him that his time was up and he had come to collect his sinful soul. Jack, staring the devil in the eye, showed not fear but a flicker of a sly grin. Thinking fast, he agreed it was his time to go but made one final request, that the devil join him for one last drink. The devil, amused by his audacity, agreed. When it came time to pay the bartender, Jack turned to the devil and said he had no money, but suggested that the devil, being a shapeshifter, could simply turn himself into a silver coin to pay for the drinks. The devil, proud of his powers, immediately transformed into a shiny coin. But instead of paying, Jack snatched the coin and shoved it deep into his pocket, right next to a small silver cross he carried with him. The holy power of the cross prevented the devil from changing back, leaving him trapped and powerless in Jack's pocket. Jack refused to let him go until the devil promised to leave him alone for 10 more years. The devil, furious but helpless, had no choice but to agree. 10 years to the day, the devil returned to claim Jack's soul. He found Jack wandering down a country road, and this time the devil was determined not to be fooled. Jack seemed to accept his fate, saying he was ready to go, but again he had one final simple request. He pointed to an apple tree and asked the devil if he would be so kind as to climb up and fetch him one last apple to eat on his journey to hell. The devil, thinking there could be no harm in it, shimmied up the tree trunk. The moment the devil was in the branches, Jack quickly pulled out his knife and carved a large cross into the bark of the tree trunk. The devil was trapped again, unable to climb down past the holy symbol. This time, Jack's demands were much greater. He told the trapped and humiliated devil that he would only let him down if he made a solemn vow to never, ever take his soul, no matter what he did for the rest of his life. The devil, with no other option, angrily made the promise, and Jack let him go. Years later, Stingy Jack's miserable life finally came to an end. He went up to the gates of heaven, but because of his greedy, sinful, and deceitful life, Saint Peter turned him away. Left with nowhere else to go, Jack went down to the gates of hell and banged on the door. But the devil appeared, and bound by the promise he had made so many years ago, refused to let him in. Jack was now trapped, barred from both heaven and hell. Crying out that he was cold and lost in the eternal darkness, he asked the devil how he would find his way. In a final act of mockery, the devil tossed Jack a single eternally burning ember from the fires of hell. Jack, who had been nibbling on a turnip, hollowed it out, placed the ember inside, and began his endless lonely journey, wandering the face of the earth with his makeshift lantern. He became known as Jack of the Lantern, or, as we say today, Jack-o'-lantern. So when you see the flickering lights of jack-o'-lanterns on a porch, or the costumed children running from house to house, you're seeing the modern echoes of ancient traditions. You're seeing the remnants of a time when people believed that the veil between worlds was thin, and when they lit fires and wore masks to protect themselves from the spirits that roamed in the darkness. It's a holiday that has been shaped by thousands of years of history, a fascinating blend of pagan ritual, Christian tradition, and modern fun. It's a night to remember the dead, to celebrate the harvest, and to face the darkness with a little bit of light, a little bit of mischief, and a whole lot of candy.